Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I never saw a paper that had more influence and more status, or whatever word you want to use, than the Daily Journal. And the reason it had it was because it was the voice of the people.
Pat McArt left a secure job in Dublin for a city where he feared he could have been killed.
Derry was a very sort of divided place. There were hunger strike graffiti on every gable wall. The Strand Road, all the lights had been shot out. Coming to Derry, you know, the second choice would have been Beirut.
Starting as a local journalist, he eventually became the editor of the Derry Journal at the height of the Troubles.
First, the soldiers sprayed the demonstrators with a water cannon, which was followed up with volleys of rubber bullets and CS gas.
I remember Dennis Bradley. Dennis had been a priest in the Bogside area. And I remember the time he told me, he says, look, it's like this. We have lost the young people of this town now after Bloody Sunday.
It was home both to IRA commander and Sinn Féin's chief negotiator, Martin McGuinness, and the key architect of the Good Friday Agreement, John Hume.
Now, Hume admired him tremendously. He had a brain the size of a planet, and he was probably the architect that got us the peace process. But I never quite got on his wavelength. The exact opposite. He was just supposed to be, you know, violent guy and all the rest of Martin McGuinness. And for almost from day one, for some reason, I got on really well with Martin.
As editor, McArt was a trusted critic and counsellor of these two local giants.
So Monday, Martin McGuinness comes down and I says, hey, by the way, Martin, there's a guy in here on Thursday, American guy, asking a whale of questions about you. Oh, he says, Jesus, Pat, what'd you say? He says, Pat, that's the guy's a spook. He's senior CIA.
In his recently launched book, War, Peace and the Derry Journal, the Donegal man relives that period in the editor's chair.
The young guy had been executed, and she says, Pat, we were used to justify the execution.
Gareth Hargan, the Belfast Telegraph's Derry reporter, spoke with the former editor to discuss his extraordinary life.
Thanks for taking the time to speak to me today, Pat. You've been on a busy mini tour of Derry and Donegal for the launch of War, Peace and the Derry Journal. I was just wondering, how is the book launch going?
It's actually gone very well, Gareth. In fact, I have to be honest, much better than I thought it was. It's basically, the market was basically Derry, Donegal, and to a certain extent, Tyrone. And we're near enough sold out for the first printing, which is we're delighted with. And it seems to have struck a chord. I am originally from Letterkenny, and I think we had a book signing in Letterkenny, and it sold something like 300 copies in the one day, which the guy in the bookstores was a bit of a record. So you can't do better than that. What is it they said, Gareth, about a prophet never recognising his own land? So it was lovely to go back to my hometown and see so many old people and old friends, I mean, who came along and bought the book. So and it's been very good in Derry too. It's all in all, it's been very, very successful.
And your journalism career started out in Dublin, didn't it, before you moved to Dublin, then to work for the RTE?
No, I started off in Letterkenny. I started off with a newspaper. I actually started off doing accountancy, but somewhere along the way I discovered I'd be the world's worst accountant. You know, if there was 10 quid missing, rather than go look for it, I'd just say, here's the 10 quid and I'm out of here. It just bored the hell out of me. So I got a job working with this newspaper called the Derry People, which is a total misnomer, never even sold in Derry. But the guy who had set it up had originally intended to set it up in Derry and had moved to Donegal, and he found the sales were actually far better in Letterkenny, so he just stayed in Letterkenny. And it was a very successful wee paper. Anyway, I started working for them for about 6 years, ended up in charge of it. And anyway, I was sort of bored. I'd been doing it for about 6-7 years. And one day I came home and the wife says, did you see the RTE are looking for journalists? So I said, are they? And for some, now I was married and we had one child at that stage. I think we had two at that stage. And I just sort of sat down, sort of filled in the application for a bit of a laugh, just because I was bored, never expecting to go anywhere. I ended up getting a job. And what was odd about it was there was massive recession in Ireland at that time and there was very few jobs. And apparently about 3,000 or 4,000 people had actually applied for jobs. You know, a lot of people with degrees in English and all the rest who had never been near a newspaper. So even getting an interview was quite an achievement. So that sort of set me off in the path, went off to Dublin, worked in RTE, worked on the subs desk, worked on the bloody old unit. And then after a while, I got talking to the late, great Larry Doherty, who was the chief photographer of the Journal. And he was telling me that the Journal were looking for a chief reporter, but they were, quote unquote, really looking for an editor. So that's how I came back to Derry.
And in the book, you mentioned that your mother had said that it was a good job down in RTE and basically had questioned why you left it. So what was it that attracted you back to the Northwest?
My mother thought I was insane. You know, here I was the local boy made good, getting a job with a national broadcaster in Dublin. You know, it was well paid and compared to, you know, local journalism. It was pensionable, it had a status. And you could, in actual fact, Jared, which is a strange thing, when I told the editor I was leaving, he says, geez, Paddy, he says, look, there's a chief sub-editor's job going down the Dáil. And he says, I had sort of you earmarked for that and so on. And that would have been nice money. So when I told my mother I was coming back to Derry, and I remember the hunger strikes were in full swing. Derry was a very sort of divided place. There were hunger strike graffiti on every gable wall. The Strand Road, all the lights had been shot out. Coming to Derry, you know, the second choice would have been Beirut. You know, so coming to Derry was not, and my mother thought, you're going to, stood up, she thought, and this is what she did think, she thought I was going to end up getting myself either shot or killed or injured or something. She thought, you know, it was a madness leaving a well-paid, safe, secure, pensionable job in Dublin to come to Derry where it was, what was going on was total civil unrest, yeah.
And as you say, the book describes Derry's West Bank as being the biggest open-air prison in Europe by 1981. Checkpoints were everywhere and the rural roads in Donegal were sealed off with concrete bars, wrap and barbed wire. Mm-hmm. At that time, the IRA hunger strikes were also making the headlines. It must have been an incredibly tense time to be here. And I imagine there was a great responsibility that came with editing a paper of such renown. Can you take me back to them? Was it daunting?
We lived down Culmore, and when you went up to the, there was a checkpoint. If you went round the other side, Coshcun, there was a checkpoint. If you went out, and of course in the city centre, there was checkpoints. At every gate and the walls, there was a checkpoint. It was like people were living here, but, and then of course there was raids in the middle of the night, British Army raids, there was arbitrary arrests. You know, sometimes the soldiers would go into houses and they would wreck the place just deliberately to annoy people. If they saw something they thought was but precious, like a photograph or something, or a frame or something, they would wreck it deliberately, you know, and they would cut up, and maybe you got a new suite that you'd paid up. They would deliberately, you know, get a knife out and say, oh, well, you thought you were hiding guns or ammunition and all that. And there was a lot of aggro and so on. And it was not a nice time. Anybody refers to them as the good old days. I was got to be kidding. I remember Martin McGinnis was chatting one day and he says, hey, Paddy, you seriously think that this is good fun? I want this over and done with so my children don't have to go through this. It was not, Garrett, it was certainly not a nice time. There was a lot of stress. A lot of people, you know, there were people getting lifted. There was, and farmers, there was touts, there was everything under the sun. And there was a lot of people, I would say, were living on their nerves. You know, Derry today is 180 degrees different. Derry today is basically like Donegal. Back then, it certainly was not like Donegal. You know, you walked out down the street in Derry now, there's no army Saracens going past with guys sticking their rifles out the window. There's no, or you see running around in big, heavy duty, well, not anymore, not just as far as I see, or you see Land Rovers and all that sort of stuff. Derry and Letterkenny these days could pass for two very similar towns. Back then, it was day and night.
And you were only 28 at the time as well. And was taking on a very big role being the editor at the time. Was it daunting?
It was. And you know, the funny thing was, I wasn't even a hardy household name in my own house. Never mind anything. And I think a lot of people in Derry was, what under God are they giving a wet behind the ears, Donegal man, the job as editor of Derry Journal, all the people they have in Derry and so on. And I got to admit, some days I was asking myself the same thing. So it was a big undertaking. The other thing as well, when I went into the Journal, most of the people were older than me. When I walked around the place, you know, out in the floor, you know, with the makeup people and the printers and all the rest, every one of them was older than me. There was a cohort of young apprentices and a couple of young reporters younger than me, but that was about it. You know, the rest were older. So it was a strange time to come in. And I remember one day this woman came in. I don't know even now what she came in for. And I came out and she says, "Hey, son, I want to speak to her." And I was about to, "You need to go in." And I said, "Oh, geez, wait a minute, I'm not her." So, you know, and she said to me, "Oh, no, son, it's a much older man than you." You know, and then I realised, you know, but anyway, that was life. And no, it was a big undertaking at 28 when I think back at it.
And the coming from Donegal allowed you to look at things here with a wider lens?
You know, Gareth, what really, really got me, my father was what would you say, he was a news junkie. That's the only way I can describe him. He got up in the morning and he put on RTE News at 7 o'clock. He would put on the BBC headlines, I think, at 7:30. And before he'd leave, he went to work at 8 o'clock in the morning. He would listen to something else. Back in those days, he was able to come home and he'd put on the 1 o'clock news on RTE. And at 6 o'clock, he'd have on the RTE News. And at 9 o'clock, he'd have on the RTE News. And in between, he'd watch maybe ITN and maybe BBC. He bought a newspaper in the morning and he bought a newspaper in the evening. Right, I'll give you an example how well it worked. I went to RTE and I was sent down one of the first days I was there, down for a bit of training on the sub-editor's desk. And after about 10 minutes, the chief sub-editor says, "You can leave." And I went, "What?" He says, "You can leave." I said, "Now, there were three or four other people and they were there for the best part of the week and I was told I could leave after." And I says, "Wait a minute, why can I leave?" And he says, "You've really got it." Now, don't kid yourself, Gareth. I am no genius, far from it. But I had listened to so much RTE that almost by osmosis I'd taken on the style. And that was down to me dad, because I had listened to so much RTE news, I was able to do the style and so on. That was a gift he gave me.
And you mentioned in the book that BBC Northern Ireland didn't reflect a nationalist perspective back then. In a recent documentary, former BBC One controller Sir Paul Fox said anti-Catholic prejudice was deeply embedded at the corporation during the Troubles, with the truth about what was happening to Catholics in places like Derry effectively hidden. Do you agree with that assessment then?
And 100%. Absolutely 100%. The BBC back then, give you a simple example. Down, I think it was 1961, Down got the final of the All-Ireland, the Gaelic football. Apparently somewhere in the region of 30,000 people travelled across the border down to Dublin to Croke Park to watch Down won their first All-Ireland. As far as I'm aware, BBC Northern Ireland gave the result. Oh, and in today's All-Ireland final, Down beat whoever it was. And that was it. 30,000 people from Down and all the rest. It was basically, there was this idea that there was this sort of pastoral sort of thing about Northern Ireland, that the Queen could visit Hillsborough and go down the, you know, Belfast and so on and so on. They never said, "Wait a minute, why doesn't the Queen come to Derry or go down the Bogside? Why can't she come to Strabane or Newry or anything?" And there was this sort of, you know, almost this sort of little pastoral pieces where it was a land of milk and honey. It was far from it. There was the I remember, I think it was the Roundtree Foundation, somewhere about the early 1980s, did a survey of poverty in Derry, or poverty in the British Isles. And I think three or four of the top 10 wards for poverty in all of the British Isles were in Derry. And I think one was in Strabane. I think the other one was West Belfast. So I think three or four of the top 10. That's the way back in. So that was, you know, Bishop Daly, he wrote it in his book, but I remember being at various functions with him. And he frequently told stories of 26 and 27 people living in the one house in Derry.
And against that backdrop, then, did it make it more important for the Derry Journal to amplify the voices of nationalists in the North?
The Derry Journal, the reason that I never saw a paper that had more influence or more status or whatever word you want to use than the Derry Journal, and the reason it had it was because it was the voice of the people. It wasn't just a newspaper. It was a political organ. It was a sort of given people who had no other way of expressing themselves. And the journal stood up for them. It was, you know, it was so many things. I'm not even sure I'm explaining right. The journal was so important. UTV was unionist establishment. BBC was unionist establishment. Belfast Telegraph was unionist establishment. Newsletter was unionist establishment. The Irish News back then was a very different paper. People used to say it was basically greyhounds and horse racing.
The RTE as well at the time, were they as culpable for basically silencing national voices?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think I'll use the term, anything that was sympathetic towards why, you know, young nationalists were taking the position they did, you know, it was almost strangled at birth. I remember Dennis Bradley. Dennis had been a priest in the Bogside area and around the Bloody Sunday. And I remember the time he told me, he says, look, it's like this. We have lost the young people of this town now after Bloody Sunday. He says, the Catholic priest telling people to behave, you know, rationally and sort of don't get angry and don't do this and don't do that. You know, act morally and all. He says, they're not listening. He says, there's the anger is there. He says, they see injustice, they see bigotry, they see sectarianism. And he says, tell them to just accept it and turn the other cheek. He says, that's not working.
And you'll be aware of the cuts they Radio 4 not so long ago there, and kind of nationalist papers would have less of a presence here than they did years ago, back in your day, I'd imagine, as well. So do you think that has Derry's voice been weakened over time?
Well, you see, the claim was when I came to Derry in 1981, and I remember before I arrived, I was told there was three jobs in Derry that counted. One was the MP, John Hume. Second, the Catholic Bishop, Edward Daly. And the third one was the editor of the Derry Journal. I think it was Larry Doherty, the chief photographer of the Derry Journal, told me. I'm thinking it was him. But, and all three of those people, like Hume, and I've seen him doing it as well. He could ring up, you know, managing editors of newspapers like the Washington Post and all the rest. He could ring up serious, serious players, senators in America and so on. And he did it one day in my office. You know, Bishop Daly was world famous. You know, that famous iconic photograph of carrying, you know, the blood-stained handkerchief. Like, I went across the world. He had status. He could go and ring up anybody and, you know, get, you know, arrange an interview for you. And the editor of the Derry Journal at that stage, you know, the Derry Journal was a very, very influential paper, you know. So, I think all three, like, there's nobody on, like, of Hume's status, and that's no disrespect to Colin Eastwood. Hume was of a time and a place.
And you touched on some of those big names from back in the day. You had John Hume, you had Martin McGuinness, you had Eamon McGann, and you had Gregory Campbell as well, a colourful cast with different worldviews. But could you explain maybe your first impressions of them and did it change over time?
Oh, yeah. Like I've said this a million times, I was brought up in a house where you'd call it old-fashioned conservative right-wing Catholicism. That would mainly be my mother. Now, she was the salt of the earth. She would carry you on your back. But she was an old-fashioned school. And she would have, put it like this, she would have put John Hume up there with Jesus Christ and the Pope on a wall, and she would put Martin McGuinness down the floor and all the rest of it. I came to Derry, and for some reason, now Hume, I admire him tremendously. He had a brain the size of a planet, and he was probably the architect that got us the peace process. But I never quite got on his wavelength. The exact opposite. He was this supposed to be, you know, violent guy and all the rest of Martin McGuinness. And for almost from day one, for some reason, I got on really well with Martin. I liked him, and I'm not shy about saying it, because, and it was all the days I'd dealt with him, he was more than honourable, and he kept his word. And I remember we were having various private conversations, and he would tell me things, and then he would say, keep it to yourself and all the rest of it, and so on. And I learned to trust him, and I think he learned to trust me. And, you know, even in sometimes in my own family, I think some people think, oh, you've been sort of brainwashed by these dangerous subversives. But like I keep saying, we shouldn't read or believe what we read in the various newspapers by people who had never met him, who had nothing to do with him, didn't understand where he's coming from and all the rest of it. And I've seen so much. Like when you see people like Ruth Dudley Edwards and Owen Harris and people like that writing about Martin McGuinness, and they have never even met him. And I'm going, how under God do you people, you know, even, you know, have any sort of credibility when you write about people like that? But I mean, that's a wee personal hobby of mine.
And you mentioned in the book that you did have massive moral issues at one stage. So did that kind of change over time once you got to know
him? Martin didn't pull any punches in. There was a sort of moral certitude. Martin said to me one day, he said, I have no problem living with myself, none. He says, I didn't go looking for this war. This war came to my town. He says, there's bigotry, discrimination. And he says, look at the way, he says, when our people went to the street, he says, Eddie McAteer and them, on October 5th. And he says, see the way they were treated by the police? And then he says, I can't remember the names of the two guys now, God forgive me, but there were two guys, he says, friends of his, or people he knew in his area, shot dead by the British Army. And he says, I decided I was joining the IRA. He says, I wasn't putting up with this. And he split it to me one day. He says, right, Pat, he says, in any society, he says, there And he referenced Norwegians. There's a name for the people there during the Second World War. He said, basically, he says, there are people like in Norway when the Germans came who will try and get along with the Germans. There are people who will sort of ignore them. And their third group will be those who fight back. And we can all figure out what group Merton belonged to, you know.
And I think it would come as a surprise to people that you said neither McGinnis or Hume would have been extroverts. Was that your experience of them?
Merton was actually, he was a very nice man, you know, in fact, everybody, man. But Merton wasn't all singing, all dancing, you know. I remember the time the GAA, Derry, won the first All-Ireland, and there was a big reception from him down at the Guildhall. And I remember Merton came in, and instead of going way up to the top of the stage, no, he could have done it. His brother Tom had played GAA for Derry. His family were involved and so on. But I remember he stood way back down the back of the hall, you know, the same everybody else, and then left. Didn't try to get any sort of kudos or, you know, photographs or anything like that. I remember thinking, you know, there's a modesty there that, you know, that you wouldn't think. And I think he didn't want to be honing in on somebody else's glory and stayed away, you know, and I admired him for it.
You noted in the book the shift in dynamics in politics when you took over at the Journal.
Yeah.
In the book, you say one other significant editorial decision I took was if Sinn Féin or IRA issued a major statement of interest, I would run it as a lead. If young DUP firebrand Gregory Campbell had something to say, he would be on the front page too. You know that like the paper was branded at times a Republican rag.
Oh, absolutely.
How did you take that criticism?
I really didn't give a monkey's. I really genuinely didn't. I reached a stage of saying, look, if you're standing, you know, can you imagine these days if you're in Palestine, you're if you try and sort of explain what's happening to the Palestinians, somebody comes along, oh, you're nothing but a Hamas rag. You're going to get that anyway. Right. When you consider that when the corporation was prorogued, there was 20 seats on it. 12 seats went to unionists. 8 went to nationalists. And the city, there was almost 70% nationalists. You know, then in Stormont, there was never a Catholic minister. And the whole time of Stormont, there's that. At one stage in the early 60s, the REC was 93% Protestant. The B specials were 100% Protestant and unionists. And somebody then tries to tell you that's a fair society, that and, you know, and that people who rebel against that and people who, you know, that they're the terrorists and they're the troublemakers and all the rest of it. And that's why it took a real go at the media and Dublin 4 type media, RT. There was so much they could have explained so much better. Put a lot of the violence in context. No, I'm not saying you justify violence. I've never said that. And I was never a supporter of the IRA. But I have said there was so much that could have been explained. Like a lot of people who joined IRA were very decent people. And, you know, a lot of people say that can't be true. Of course it was true. You know, do you think Patrick Pearce was a terrorist? Do you think James Connolly was a terrorist? No, if Martin McGuinness had been brought up in Derbyshire, did you think he would have been joining some sort of, you know, what the heck? No, it was time and place.
The Journal covered many dark days in Derry's history. You made reference to the law of the jungle having precedence back at that time. Are there any specific stories that stand out in your mind, either for their brutality or...
I remember Cecil McGill telling me one time, and it obviously had an effect on Cecil. He says some young guy had been executed, this is way back in their days, as an informer. And Cecil went up and he says, the young fellow was sort of kneeling. He says, as if in prayer, and he says, had a terrible effect on him. And then, of course, there was a couple of other young guys shot as informers. And I remember thinking that was the most horrible thing because their families would have to live with that. And, you know, and sometimes, I've got to admit, Gareth, I used to wonder about how strong was the evidence, you know, and I never quite agreed with that, you know. And I referenced a couple of stories in the book and so on. I remember one woman after her son was shot, or executed, she came down to see me, and to put it mildly, the hatred she had for me was, you know, visceral. She basically said that her son had been shot dead on a Thursday for a headline for the Derry Journal and so on. And there's a certain element to it, isn't it? Because they wanted it as the lead story and were sending out a message, you know. At that time now, there was a lot of informing going on and people were getting lifted. And I presume the Republicans were, at that stage, on edge all the time because they didn't know who was coming next. And they were sending out a message. But having said that, you know, it was a brutal game. Absolutely brutal game.
Would they have done that at times then? The Sinn Féin or the IRA would have wanted to send a message out through there.
Absolutely, there's no doubt about that. You know, and there was one time, there was a young fella down from the bog. He had been, the normal format was, if they discovered an informer, if the guy went public, or and it usually was a guy went public, they would have a press conference. So what happened was that one Thursday, there was a press conference, and the late, great Siobhan McElhinney was sent up to it, and a photographer, and anyway, the young fella was there, and he admitted being an informer. And usually, Belfast Telegraph might have sent somebody, and the Irish News might have sent somebody, and Radio Foyle might have sent somebody, and all this. But this day, the only person was there was Siobhan, and our photographer. We come down, and I think we might have put it in page 3 or 4. The dairyman admits being an informer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I go up to my mother and father's house on a Saturday, and I stay overnight, me and my wife and my kids. And I'm sitting early Sunday morning, phone. Like, I always give Siobhan my number, and anyway, and my mother's house. This is before mobile phones. I mean, bottom line of it all, she rang me and she was really, really upset. The young guy had been executed, and she says, Pat, we were used to justify the execution. So I got made it known to certain senior Republicans, we will never attend a press conference like that, if anything. So after that, any press conferences, there was no shootings or anything, you know, because I said we'd never cover them again. So that was it. And I remember feeling very uptight. I remember the shooting of the young guy in the bog. We had the lead story on ITN. And the next thing, the front page of the Derry Journal came up. And I think it was a man called Mike Nicholson. I think he said, this is what it's like, the law of the jungle in a British city, you know. And that was the reference to shooting dead of a young fellow as an informer in Derry. And the lead story was the Derry Journal.
And with so much violence going on at the time, was it hard to strike a balance in the paper and reflect what was going on in society?
There was a bit of not seeing the wood for the trees, if you know what I mean. It was, you come in the morning and it was hell for leather. It was, I would say, easily the busiest newspaper office in the country. There was always something going on. And as was that, you had Hume, you had McGuinness, you had Bishop Daly, you had McCann, you had Seamus Heaney, you had Brian Friedel, you had everything on this. And Derry was punching way, way above its weight back then. The characters Derry had then, you know, they were all sort of nearly on a world stage. And Derry was the cradle of the troubles. And Derry, in a way, is the cradle where it ended as well. Somebody said, Tom Collins, of the former editor of the Irish News, said in a review of the book, he says, Pat McGart was in the room when history was made. And I never thought about that because I was just doing my job. But when I look back at it now, yeah, I was. And by the way, I don't mean that arrogantly, and I don't mean, but there were things happening, and, you know, so on. Like, I'll give you a simple example. There's a woman called Kathleen Green. She was the consul general of them at the American consul in Belfast. And she rang me up one day, and I'd say this was a Monday, and she says, Pat, look, there's a guy coming over. He wants to, could he come down and see you? And he wants to come down Thursday. And I said, Kathleen, no, look, Kathleen, Thursday is hell for a letter. I can hardly talk to my wife and children on a Thursday. Like, it is, you know, back then, it was a, you just remember, guys, this, it's different technology, and this was slow technology, and you had to keep going, 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 because if you had a big paper, there was no sort of putting it up on a screen and doing this. You had to get it all set, cut and paste, and all this sort of stuff, and it was really hard going on, quick going on. So anyway, bottom line, if she rang again Tuesday, and I says no, and she rang again on the Wednesday, and she was pleading at this stage. I said, all right, Kathy, no, I decided I'll not go and get me dinner. I'll sit on my desk, have a cup of tea and a sandwich, and I'll chat this guy. So in comes this guy, and as I keep saying, he was straight out of Central Casting. No teeth you could see your reflection in. No, that white coat that the Secret Service all wear and all this. Blonde hair and about 6'4". You know, and I thought, Jesus, where'd you get him? Anyway, he comes in and he sits down and starts asking a wild lot of questions. But I'm not really paying attention because I'm thinking, well, what, see about that lead story. You know, did I check with that there with, you know, some reporter? What about that advertisement on page 3? And I was half listening to him and half not. So anyway, he came and by the way, he was supposed to stay 15 minutes. He stayed an hour and a half. And I actually had to say that Thursday, look, you got to go. I've got to. So anyway, that was Thursday. See, if I was off Friday. And I remember saying, wait a minute, that was a strange thing, this guy here and all the rest. And I remember thinking, what was all that all about, you know, when I got time to reflect. So Monday, Martin McGuinness comes down and I says, Martin was just about to leave. He brought down a statement about someone around. And I said, hey, by the way, Martin, there's a guy in here on Thursday, American guy, asking a whale lot of questions about you. And I remember his name then. I remembered his name then, don't remember it now. And I said, I told him, Martin came back in the room and he said, oh, he says, Jesus, Pat, what'd you say? And I said, wait a minute, what are you getting so excited about? He said, Pat, that guy's a spook. He's senior CIA And the whole idea, the whole thing was they were doing an investigation for Bill Clinton on whether to give Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams visas to visit the States. So that's my role in the peace process. And I, you see, what I remembered was the guy kept asking me, did I trust Martin McGuinness? If he gave me a word, would I trust him? What sort of person was he? And I was wondering, what's this got to do with anything? You know, my views of Martin McGuinness on a personal level, it wasn't politics and it wasn't media. It was about Martin the person. So they were down checking him out. That's really what they were doing.
So that was that at the start of kind of negotiations around the ceasefire?
Around the ceasefire. I remember Clinton gave them a visa to come out, and basically the whole idea then was to sort of bring them into the peace process. You know, they were outside looking in, you know, they were the IRA, they were the bad guys, but then suddenly Clinton, you know, the doors started opening, and that was a big part of it.
Post-Good Friday Agreement then, I was wondering, being in Derry, was there... was there a backlash from dissident Republicans at that time then?
Yeah. I remember some of the dissidents. Is this what we thought? See, one day I just, after the thing was signed up to, I just, Martin, what, go and tell me someone, what's this all about? There's a lot of guys coming into me. Is this what we fought for? Is this what, you know, a lot of people spent time in jail for? Is this, you know, all the rest of it? And I remember, always remember the analogy he used, and it was like, he said, no, at Fort out in Greenham, at Burt. I said, yeah. He says, no, the way, he says, if you're at something and you want to change it, he says, you can walk around and hit your head against the wall. And he says, you know, nothing's going to change. But he says, then you come to the door and you say, now, if I get in there inside that door, maybe I can change things in there, but the danger is going through that door. You know, so in other words, do you change someone from within or without? I remember, he says, look, he says, Pat, no matter what anybody says, he says, we could keep this war going for another 20 years. And he says, unfortunately, so can they. And he says, we've had 20, whatever it was, 25 years of it. He says, we need to try and find another way. So he says, the big danger, he says, for Republicans has gone into this thing and getting sucked into this whole thing. But he says, we've had 25 years. He says, I don't know, he says, what do these people who want to keep on fighting? And he referred to them, some of them, as ceasefire soldiers. He says, these guys were not to be seen during the war. But he says, suddenly when they called the ceasefire, these boys have sold out and all the rest. So there was all sorts of, different interpretations of the ceasefire and what it was all about.
And how would you have handled it then at the time, dissident republicanism? And like, would there have been any coverage in the...
But the thing about the dissidents, I think they could have had a meeting on a phone box at one stage. There were so few of them, you know, there's a lot of anger. Like I know one very decent sort of guy that I says, Pat, I didn't spend X number of years in jail for this. And then and I says, well, are you going to join the dissidents? He says, no. Basically, he says, Republicanism is the only game in town. I'm not going to join that. But he was disillusioned a lot with what had gone for him. It was United Ireland or nothing. But then, you know, as a journey or a destination, you know, United Ireland, I think it's a journey. You just can't sort of say, we've arrived. You have to sort of go down the road and change people's minds.
With your experience of working as an editor here from 1981, how do you think the city has changed between then and now?
The city, one of the nice things about the city, Derry is now, leaving aside the economics to a certain extent, the city socially, culturally, physically, everything that you can think of has changed. I go for a walk sometimes along the foyer, and you see all this people sitting out. You see people walking. You know, there's it's almost, what would you say, that sort of continental feel about Derry. You know, the people, you know, that I think the foyer is probably the most majestic river in Ireland. Derry has been transformed. There's a sort of a vibe now that's full of life. Something's happened. It's almost a people that's come back to life. Now, if we could get the economic development to match this cultural and the social and the physical, Derry looks brilliant these days. There's so many young people. There's a great vibe. There's a whole thing about Derry is absolutely superb. And I think it's something that should be built on.
So you can see brighter days ahead for Derry down the line.
You know, I don't believe in, like, I wouldn't use violence or shoot anybody to achieve United Ireland. But I think anybody with a brain, George Osborne, the former Chancellor in Britain, said the way things are going, that economically Dublin and Brussels would be more important to Northern Ireland than London. And he said that politics will follow. And I think that's basically what's happening.
Thanks very much for your time, Pat. I appreciate it.
Not at all, Gert.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.